study the effects of cosmic radiation on plants and microorganisms. China is not a partner in the ISS, and its astronauts have not been able to access the station. U.S. rules prohibit NASA, a participating agency in the ISS, from engaging in bilateral partnerships with China. A new space lab means researchers can repeat experiments that have been conducted on the ISS to test whether the results can be reproduced, says D'Souza, who hopes the findings will be made public. I am here on the edge of my seat, just waiting for the results, he says. The website of Asia Financial also reported more than 25 research projects already underway, including those to study the effects of microgravity on plant cells, bone, and muscle, as well as on molten materials together with protein crystallization experiments, says Zhang Wei, a director at the Technology and Engineering Center for Space Utilization, Chinese Academy of Sciences in Beijing. Chinese state news media also reported that the crew took some 12,000 seeds, including alfalfa, oats, and fungal seeds, to the space station, exposing them to cosmic radiation and microgravity for 6 months before returning them in April to be planted on Earth. Researchers at the Chinese Academy of Sciences have also reported that tailcress and rice seedlings grown in Ventian in late July have started to sprout. Mengjian will take off on a Long March 5B rocket from the Wenchang launch site in southern China. The rocket will probably perform an uncontrolled re-entry into the atmosphere, and several tons of debris could crash somewhere on the Earth's surface, as has happened with previous missions using this type of rocket. Some scientists worry the debris could fall in a populated area. The risk is real, says McDonnell. Fortunately, most of the surface of the Earth is ocean or empty land, so the chance of hitting a heavily populated area is low. Asia Financial also added Tiangong will be the world's second lab in orbit and is set to host more than 1,000 scientific experiments over the next 10 years. The station will be China's first access to a space lab, as its astronauts have not been permitted to use NASA's existing International Space Station, ISS.
Midstream.
In Ukraine is prolonged and no ceasefire is reached before the start of next spring, then no doubt the region of West Asia will not be excluded from the heat, which will lead to a shuffle in strategic alliances. The consequences resulting from the outbreak of the war in Ukraine proved the restored importance of West Asia as a region which no power aspiring to unilateral hegemony of the world order can dispense with or refrain from extending its influence towards. This was evident by the emergence of new roles of important West Asian countries such as Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, and the state of paranoia currently manifesting in the Israeli occupation entity. For instance, Saudi Arabia is one of the most important strategic allies of the United States of America and the Middle East since World War II. However, the war in Ukraine came to cast a negative shadow on that alliance and now threatens to completely break it. U.S. President Biden's resort to the weapon of maximum sanctions against Russia, especially in the field of oil, gave Saudi Arabia a great opportunity to appear as an influential player on the course of the Ukrainian war through its ability to influence the oil market and its prices, thus disturbing the effectiveness of the economic sanctions imposed on Russia. On the other hand, it is noted that Russian-Israeli relations are likely to be negatively and severely affected by the consequences of the war in Ukraine. Several reports emerged indicating that Israel has begun or has already provided various aids to Ukraine, including types of advanced weapons, especially air defense systems, in addition to very important intelligence information, which led to an annoyed reaction on the part of Russia. Moreover, the development of the situation in Ukraine pushed Iran to express its solidarity with Russia and its strategic stance with it. Recently, it was reported that Russia had allegedly bought a large deal of Iranian drones. Both countries denied the allegations, yet it still angered the United States, prompting it to make strong worded statements warning Iran of the consequences and threatening to impose new sanctions on it. Meanwhile, in Turkey, the growing personal trust between Putin and Erdogan is steadily increasing, especially after Putin's proposal to export Russian gas to Europe via Turkey, turning the latter into a center for storing and redistributing it to Europe, a proposal that Erdogan received with great happiness and enthusiasm. Hence, if the ongoing war in Ukraine is extended and no viable solution is found, then there is no doubt that this will lead to a complete reversal of the pattern of alliances in West Asia. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The ongoing war in Ukraine has wide-ranging geostrategic repercussions, which are likely to affect various international actors, whatever their sizes or political weights. And since all the influential forces on the international scene, not just Russia and Ukraine, are involved in this war, either directly or indirectly, in addition to the fact that it is a war conducted by various available means and not by force of fire or by military means alone, its effects and repercussions are likely to vary greatly from one region to another and from one country to another. West Asia in particular is likely to have the lion's share of these effects and repercussions, whose goals and orientations often face off to the point of contradiction. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Laith Maarouf, political commentator. Thanks a million for being with us, Laith. It's a pleasure. Much has been said about what the West calls the Middle East, which is West Asia, losing its strategic importance, flee with the United States of America, which at times seemed to be withdrawing from the region gradually, but in reality, it was simply attempting to redeploy its forces in the region and changing their locations of concentration and influence all across the world, not just here. But has the conflict in Ukraine proven that West Asia is no longer a hotspot of neo-colonial and imperial ambitions?
On the contrary, actually, as you mentioned in your intro, what the war in Ukraine is proving is the importance of Western Asia. You know, Ukraine is just a few countries away from Syria. It's the Black Sea, Turkey, and then Syria south of that. We're very close. And of course, the history of the Zionist project begins in Ukraine. Many of our listeners may not remember this, but the Zionist project was birthed in Ukraine, as we see today. The president of Ukraine is a Zionist Jewish president. He is allied with the Nazis on the ground, and the Zionist colony is aligning with Ukraine on those grounds. The region of Western Asia will continue to be the most important piece of territory on this planet because of geography. It is at the crossroads of Asia, Africa, and Europe. It hosts, you know, the largest amount of gas and oil in the world, and all the main trading routes pass through it. Any empire that wants to project its power into Africa and Asia has no choice but to control this region. And of course, as we see today, the battle in Ukraine is directly influencing what is happening on the ground in Syria, in Lebanon, in Iraq, and in Palestine. As we see the pressures mounting on the Americans on the ground in Syria with constant attacks by the resistance and or the constant attacks by the Israelis on Syria, and how that is playing between the two major powers in the mm-hmm. world, the United States and Russia.
Well, as you just said now, Laith, the region of West Asia, there's like no power aspiring to unilateral hegemony over the world order can dispense with or can rise above its influence in this region, as evidenced by the emergence of new roles in the region, specifically like in countries like Iran, like Saudi Arabia, like Turkey. And we also seen the paranoia in the Israeli entity, just as you mentioned. They are struggling to maintain their historic plundering of Palestine. How do you see new alliances being formed in West Asia as a direct result of the growing struggle for influence in the region, especially between the United States of America and the Russian Federation?
Of course, the strongest alliance in Western Asia is that of the resistance axis. And the other players that you mentioned, Turkey and Saudi Arabia, are right now in a bind. Their old imperial benefactor, the United States, is collapsing. Its power is not being as influential as before, even though that it's not totally collapsed, which means, on the one hand, you see Turkey, which is a large country with a large territory and 90-somewhat million population, is beginning to assert its own influence and its own sphere of influence. And that may be increasing as we speak right now, but also it's increasing the threat of the CIA and MI5, MI6 conducting operations in Turkey to change the regime. Similarly, in Saudi Arabia, which is in a bigger bind than Turkey because it's a smaller country population-wise, and it's also a country that has been 100 years under direct Anglo-American dictate, which means all their agencies, all their ministries, all their security forces are infiltrated to the core, which means that every time now MBS is playing a patriot or nationalist against American influence, there is a big chance that he will be removed or assassinated, replaced by the Americans.
Because since you mentioned Mohammed bin Salman and that he's playing a patriot, but I mean, how much of that is true? Is it just against the Biden administration, because they started off on the wrong foot to begin with? But is it just against the U.S. current administration, or rather it will surpass it to a strategic alliance between these two countries that have been the most powerful alliance since World War II?
Yeah, this is a little bit harder to gauge right now because, you know, we have to remember in the 1970s during the Arab oil embargo on Europe and so forth, it may have looked like these Gulf countries were doing an oil embargo to support Palestine, but the end result of it was that all the money that these Gulf countries made from the rise in prices of oil were stacked in American and British banks, which created a huge boom for the West. And in reality, those banks like Citibank and others didn't have even enough people to lend to, so they started lending to states in Africa and Latin America, and that is where the third world debt comes from the oil money that the Saudis made in the first oil embargo. So today, while it may seem that the Americans and the British are going to suffer because of the increase of oil prices by the Saudis and the Emiratis, it's actually going to bring a lot of money to Western banks, these Gulf countries have no control of their deposits. So I am a little bit doubtful about the effects of Saudi and Biden's spat. It may be all just for television consumption to allow the Saudis to look like they have some say in what they're doing.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us and talking about this, Laith Maruf, political commentator. I wish we had more time to talk about it because it's very, very important to see how things are shifting, especially in the region like West Asia, given the ongoing conflict in Eastern Europe. I want to thank you very much again for being with us. Now, please stay tuned because next we are going to talk about how Palestine is preparing for its third inevitable intifada.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The security situation in the occupied West Bank is escalating rapidly. On the ground, the occupation army's operations continue in all areas of the West Bank and occupied Al-Quds through operations of field liquidation of Palestinian civilians, isolation and arrest of political activists of all factions, and the demolition and confiscation of homes, lands, and properties of Palestinians in different parts of the West Bank and Al-Quds. On the other hand, the West Bank is witnessing an escalation in confrontation operations and the response to the incursions of the occupation army. Palestine approaches a third intifada in this following report.
After a long hesitation in undertaking a large-scale operation in the West Bank, in contrast to the one launched by the Israeli entity in 2002, Yair Lapid and Benny Gantz decided to carry out a large-scale aggression against the city of Nablus. A continuous aggression that appears in part motivated by the two men's electoral calculations, which compels them to do anything to face the contradictions with which Benjamin Netanyahu is chasing them. After fear of the repercussions that might result from any major operation preventing them from taking such a step over the past months, despite the escalation and expansion of resistance operations in the occupied territories. On the same level, the pace of individual resistance operations is rising, while Nablus and Jenin are witnessing armed resistance demonstrations reminiscent of the events during the Al-Aqsa Intifada 2000, in addition to the widespread popular participation in the funerals of the martyrs, which indicates latent patriotism, anger, and popular support growing around the option of Palestinian armed resistance. On the security level, the Israeli security reports indicate fears of an explosion in the situation, which were confirmed by Egyptian security intelligence messages sent to the Israelis that the West Bank is boiling on hot tin, while the Palestinian Authority announces its inability to control the situation because of the occupation's measures and its security, financial, and field restrictions. From a political angle, the Palestinian Authority team finds itself in a dead end in terms of any negotiations with the occupation regime, while the Palestinian division continues, which is eroding the social and political fabric and reflecting itself on the absence of the organized political activity of Hamas, Jihad, and the PLO in the West Bank. This erosion made way to the young Palestinian resistance blood to boil, forming a new faction known as Arin al-Usud, which translates into the Lion's Den. In light of the steadfastness shown by the Lion's Den and other emerging military groups and the messages of support they received from the resistance factions in Gaza, young Palestinian resistance fighters were inspired by the recently formed models and martyrs. Today, the Lion's Den can be considered as the starting spark for a large-scale military operation that the enemy leaders decided to launch against the West Bank. It appears that the meeting that took place recently between Prime Minister Yair Lapid, War Minister Benny Gantz, and Shin Bet officials who pledged to eliminate the group witnessed the adoption of the said decision and approved its implementation in the shortest possible time on the eve of the general elections in the entity. Are all these factors conducive to the outbreak of a third intifada? From an objective point of view, yes, the overall conditions that the Palestinian lives are in an appropriate recipe for the ignition of the battleground. However, the Palestinian division still weighs heavily on all the people and the factions. The Palestinian organizations lack effectiveness and field capacity in the West Bank and Al-Quds because of the absence of their tools, their bodies, and their organized networks, which are constantly targeted with arrests and security pursuits.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Damascus is Vanessa Bealey, independent journalist and photographer. Thanks a million for being with us, Vanessa, from Damascus, to talk about this pressing issue right now, especially in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Now, the pace of individual Palestinian resistance operations is rising in the West Bank, while we see Nablus and Jenin are witnessing armed resistance demonstrations, which is something of a reminiscence of the events during Al-Aqsa Intifada in the year 2000. That's 22 years ago, in addition to widespread popular participation in the funerals of the martyrs that are being killed by the Zionist entity, which also indicates latent patriotism, anger, and also popular support growing around the option of resistance. Are these events and repercussions enough to brew a third Palestinian intifada, Vanessa?
I think we've seen an escalation of resistance against the Zionist entity, but also a coming together of the resistance factions, which has not been seen before. 2 weeks ago at the Algiers conference, there was a declaration of unity between the various resistance factions. And I think what we saw in Nablus, when there were in Nablus, there were five martyrs, two of whom were not even involved in the armed insurrection against the invading and occupying Zionist forces, and one martyr from Ramallah, as far as I know. We saw the coming together of the resistance forces, both inside Nablus and reinforcements coming from Jenin to the aid of their comrades in Nablus. This is something that we really haven't seen on this scale for a very, very long time. As you said, we've seen disconnected, violent resistance against the occupying forces, but we haven't seen this level of unity. And what I thought was quite extraordinary was to see Syrian flags flying in Nablus during the funeral procession. And that is definitely an indication to me, particularly with the meeting recently in Damascus between President Assad and the leaders of the Hamas political arm. We're seeing now a really strong desire by the resistance axis to bring together all the factions that have been fighting for the liberation of Palestine. I find that very inspiring at the moment.
Well, on the security level, Vanessa, the Israeli security reports indicates fear of what they call an explosion in the situation, which actually was confirmed by Egyptian security intelligence messages sent to the Israeli regime, that the West Bank is simmering while the Palestinian Authority announced its inability to control the situation. Oh, that was a surprise. But as a result of the occupation's measures and its security and its financial and also field restrictions against the PA, it baffles me that the PA still wants to, quote, control the situation, unquote. What is the real weight of the Palestinian Authority on the ground in Palestine as the occupied territory seems to be taking matters into their own hands as we speak?
Absolutely. I think now you're seeing the resistance factions. The authority is now horizontal across all the resistance factions. It's not top down. So the PA, unless it wants to be left completely marooned and isolated as a Zionist ally, at some point it's going to have to make a decision. We've seen already that I think the PA security forces involved in solidarity with the Lion's Den and the other resistance factions that have come to the foremost in these battles. But I think what's also, coming back to the Syria axis, I think what is extraordinary that I just happened to pick up that these escalations in resistance against the Zionist occupation forces comes at a time that Israel has been targeting defense capabilities here in Syria in the last few days.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I wonder, and it's been confirmed by a few military researchers and people here on the ground, that what we might also be seeing is retaliation against what they perceive to be now the resistance axis. So attacks on Syria may well see an escalation on attacks against the Zionist forces inside the occupied territories or even from Gaza itself. So as I say, I think now we're seeing a precedent being set, whether it will be an equivalent to previous intifadas or perhaps it will be an even more powerful.
As a Levantine, that's music to my ears, Vanessa, definitely. But the overall conditions, unfortunately, in which the Palestinian lives are a suitable recipe for the ignition of an actual intifada, but the Palestinian division still weighs heavily on the entire people and the factions, especially the factions in Gaza, for that matter. What do you think is still missing for a full-fledged Palestinian intifada to hit the Zionist occupation from the river to the sea?
I think what is missing, but I think now it's starting to come into focus, has been this idea of unity, of everyone standing behind the ideology that Palestine will be free. And I think now what you're seeing, again, is an unprecedented situation where Israel is facing multiple fronts. It's facing the Syrian front, it's facing the Gaza front, it's facing the Hezbollah front, during which, of course, it recently surrendered its rights to some degree on the Karish gas line, but it surrendered in a more symbolic way in the sense that it had to come to the negotiating table because it was effectively afraid of escalation, military escalation with Hezbollah. But it's also facing, of course, the Yemeni front. Yemen now has developed
Definitely.
Missiles that can target Israeli cities. So, you know, Israel now is, in my view, with America very much bogged down in Ukraine and with its attention elsewhere, Israel is being more and more isolated. And I think the more that Israel is isolated, the more unified the resistance will be because they will see the weakness in their enemy that has not been visible for decades now due to the protection given to it by its allies in the West. So I think, you know, we're seeing finally a big chink in the Zionist armor, and I hope that the Palestinian resistance factions and their allies in Iran and Syria, and their growing number of allies, actually, let's not forget that Kuwait has recently prevented Israelis traveling through its own airspace. So we're seeing a big shift, in my view.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is certainly an amazing view for the acts of resistance in the region, but in less than a minute, don't you think that this would actually prompt the Zionist entity to take a decisive, maybe aggressive incursion against any part of the West Bank that might lead into something that we saw in 2002 in Jenin, for example?
Yes, of course. You know, what does the Zionist entity do whenever it is threatened? It replies with disproportionate force.
Massacres.
But as I say now, it's starting to look desperate. Look, Israel can't or refuses to supply weapons to Ukraine, and yet the Zionists have a huge presence in Ukraine proper, in Western Ukraine. So why can't they supply weapons to Ukraine? Why can't they join this axis, this neo-Nazi axis that the US and the UK is leading? Perhaps because they don't have the armament spare to actually give to Ukraine. Perhaps because they are feeling threatened and cornered in their own part or in their own region.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, this is okay. They may be able to retaliate against West Bank, against Jenin, against Nablus. But the arms are coming into the Palestinian resistance factions in the occupied territories and into Gaza. And so far, despite their multiple aggression against Syria, they've been unable to prevent that happening. And they've been unable to effectively target both Syrian defense capability and Syrian offense capability.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that.
Well, definitely times are changing and really fast. I want to thank you very much, Vanessa Bealey, independent journalist and photographer, joining us from Damascus to talk about this very important and historic event that is going on in Palestine. And thank you. Do wait for us next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The U.S.-Saudi relationship has gone sour after Riyadh's regime's decision, along with the rest of the OPEC Plus countries, to scale back oil production by 2 million barrels per day. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT, in an op-ed, wrote, "The OPEC Plus oil production cut has taught Washington that Saudi Arabia is not merely a client state to be called on to fulfill America's political needs to its own detriment. Recently, the United States was outraged by Saudi Arabia's decision, along with the rest of the OPEC Plus countries, to scale back oil production by 2 million barrels per day. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration, which had banked on the goodwill of the kingdom to facilitate a drop in oil prices in order to isolate Russia with an energy price cap, quickly threatened unspecified retaliatory action against the monarchy, which has been speculated to potentially amount to a freezing in arms sales." The row arguably sends the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia under lowest trajectory ever. Despite having completely different ideologies, the United States has long courted the highly conservative monarchy as one of its primary strategic partners of choice in the West Asia region, creating a long-standing relationship of mutual gain, which involved American access to oil in exchange for security for the Saudi regime, as well as arms and cooperation against its enemies in the region. This patron-client relationship model defined the ties between Western powers, including France and the UK, and the other monarchies of the Persian Gulf, including Bahrain, Kuwait, Qatar, Oman, and the UAE. London and Paris, the original colonial powers who dominated the region, set up this model by guaranteeing the independence of these nations following the demise of the Ottoman Empire and establishing them as their clients, allowing the Western nations to preserve strategic energy and military access to the West Asia region. As the 20th century progressed, the United States soon became the West Asia country's largest patron. While this partnership has allowed Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf states to enrich themselves, 2021 to 2022 has seen growing signs that, as the world changes, the convenience of such a partnership is starting to wither, with the OPEC row being a breaking point. First of all, the relationship between the U.S. and the Persian Gulf states is, as noted, a partnership of mutual convenience, and it is just that. The drastically different political and cultural outlooks of the respective countries mean there are zero value-based or ideological connections embedded in their relationship. While the U.S. advocates liberal democracy, Saudi Arabia advocates a hardline Wahhabi interpretation, which is the opposite of the Western value system. In spite of this, the United States has become increasingly aggressive in its foreign policy as multiple geopolitical confrontations have been opened up against Russia and China, and it has sought to more readily depend on compliance from friendly countries as it seeks to consolidate its global influence, including, in this case, Saudi Arabia. While countries of the global West may feel obligated to toe the line on the premise of the values of the U.S. invokes, states like Saudi Arabia do not see their relationship with Washington in the same way and probably recognize the U.S. ideological crusading as a long-term liability to themselves. What happens to Saudi Arabia, for example, if the U.S. no longer has use of it? Saddam Hussein was one such client before he became an enemy. As the Persian Gulf states are ultimately concerned with preserving their own value systems and independence, they have increasingly diversified their relationships in recent years with tilts towards Russia and China. Beijing, with its enormous demand for energy, has also become a lucrative alternative to the West. Similarly, stable ties with Moscow also allow for cooperation in the common interests of oil-exporting countries, which has also had the effect of reducing Western influence and dominance over those countries. On recognizing this, why would Saudi Arabia and the states of OPEC voluntarily undermine their own oil revenue merely to suit the geopolitical interests of the United States? The world is in the middle of an energy price crisis, exacerbated by the conflict in Ukraine. Saudi Arabia sees that the U.S. and some of its allies want to purposefully try to lower the price of oil in a bid to try and hurt Russia. However, that is not how the market works, and by extension, such a move is also an assault on Saudi and OPEC interests. While the kingdom is officially neutral in regards to Russia-Ukraine, it also recognizes that the success of an energy price cap would embolden the West to push harder against Russia, which also serves to undermine the kingdom's geopolitical independence. In other words, if the U.S. succeeded in dividing OPEC by unilaterally demanding a price cap on oil products, it would defeat the very purpose of the organization itself to protect the respective economic interests of those countries. The United States has been a useful partner to Saudi Arabia, but it is not a friend. It is not part of a bloc or ideological coalition, as let's say the UK is, but merely has seen the West as the most useful and lucrative partner to fulfill its own political needs. As those needs change, Saudi Arabia's preferences are also subject to change. Washington is therefore learning that the kingdom is not a client state to be called on when needed, and thus this very close and often contradictory partnership is starting to strain. New York Times also had an eye on this issue, writing, as President Biden was planning a politically risky trip to Saudi Arabia this summer, his top aides thought they had struck a secret deal to boost oil production through the end of the year, an arrangement that could have helped justify breaking a campaign pledge to shun the kingdom and its own crown prince. It didn't work out that way. Biden went through with the trip. But earlier this month, Saudi Arabia steered a group of oil-producing countries in voting to slash oil production by 2 million barrels per day, the opposite of the outcome the administration thought it had secured as the Democratic Party struggles to deal with inflation and high gas prices heading into the November elections. The move led angry Biden administration officials to reassess America's relationship with the kingdom and produced a flurry of accusatory statements between the two governments. Some analysts say senior American and Saudi officials have misread each other on both the dynamics of the oil market and the geopolitics around Russia, and that the Biden administration will have a hard time figuring out how things went awry. The White House has indicated it might seek retribution for Saudi decision, and some Democrats in Congress are making a push to scale back some military and economic ties to the kingdom. Even some of the president's staunchest supporters have called the episode an example of the administration sacrificing principles for political expediency and having little to show for it. There is now a level of embarrassment as the Saudis merrily go on their way, said Representative Gerald E. Connally, Democrat of Virginia and a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee.
Defense of Iranian
combatants. A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Ab on 13th in the Persian calendar or November 4th in the English calendar contains a multitude of symbolic meanings and realities. It marks a day that carries a historical significance. In a span of a couple of decades, three separate events occurred on this day that not only did they change the foundation of modern Iran, but also dealt a blow to the contemporary world order and the U.S. hegemony as we used to know it prior to 1979. U.S. greed, corruption of the Pahlavi regime in Iran and its dependence on the United States, firm resistance of the people of faith that relied on the insight of Imam Khomeini as a revolutionary leader, the presence of the young generation on the scene, and the valor and boldness of the revolutionary generation against the United States, whose face had been made up to look formidable, these are all meanings that are embodied by the Ab on 13th. In November 1979, Iranian citizens took 52 Americans in the U.S. Embassy in Tehran for 444 days. Americans were shocked and outraged, but it would have come as no surprise to those who remembered or took part in the coup that overthrew the nationalist government of the Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953. It was concocted in that very same American embassy in Tehran. In historical context, Americans have not bothered much about the betrayal of democracy in Iran in order to create a client regime whose purpose would be to further pursue the so-called U.S. national security interests, but they were kept in the dark about this crisis. Indeed, 13th of Avan is one of these dates that contains a huge number of important points and issues. Issues that are not only historical, but rather part of our current issues. To take a closer look at the events that Oban 13th represents, stay with us on this edition of Iran Today. The 13th of Aban also marks the anniversary of two other important events in the history of contemporary Iran. On that day, in 1964, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi forced Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini into exile, first to Turkey and then to Najaf, Iraq. The Imam returned to Iran triumphantly on February 1, 1979, after the Shah had gone into exile on January 16, 1979. He was sent to exile because of a speech delivered to the people and seminaries of Qom. He voiced his objection to the legal immunity of American agents.
I was looking at the documents that have also been printed. It said that the person in charge of the desk of the CIA organization on November 11 came to Iran. At that time, Isfahan was the main center for the councils because it was more secure. He went there and ordered the Imam to be exiled.
At the time, Americans had tens of thousands of agents in Iran. They were political, security, and military agents. They were among the people who used to manage Iran in the army, in intelligence organizations, planning centers, and etc. Imam Khomeini said that if a low-ranking American agent insulted and stomped on an Iranian prominent religious scholar in the country and committed whatever crime he wished, the Iranian legal system would remain totally neutral and nobody would have the right to stop him.
The reforms intended by the U.S. in Iran, which we call first the land reforms and then the White Revolution, were completely defined in line with the interests of the U.S. In this historical period, the United States had come to the conclusion that in order to prevent Iran from entering the group of pro-Soviet countries, it should carry out economic and cultural reforms and somehow develop the economic environment of Iranians and bring them in line with liberal democratic views. Because of this, religious practices in Iran considered these reforms to be against the native and Islamic atmosphere of the country, and it's from this point onwards that religious movements, especially the Imam, are looking for a serious criticism of the White Revolution that was intended by the Shah.
Therefore, they arrested the Imam immediately and transferred him to Tehran. Ayatollah Khomeini's objection was rooted in a sense of religiosity. It was rooted in national and Islamic pride, and it relied on public support. Although the people were unaware of their situation in the beginning, when they heard his message, they supported the Imam. It was that public support which led to the victory of the Iranian nation 14 years later.
During the Pahlavi period, they wanted to do anything. Oil contracts, consortiums, they did everything. Whose loss was this? The nation, of course. Now that there has been a revolution and that the Pahlavi regime has disappeared, it is normal for countries that have interests here, such as England, France, Germany, and especially the United States, to abandon it. But just one day after the victory of the revolution, some of our islands were occupied by the Americans.
Speaking of the public support, it was also on November 4, 1978, that a gathering of teenage students on the campus of the University of Tehran was attacked by the Shah security forces. They were staging a peaceful rally calling for the return home from exile of their beloved leader, Imam Khomeini. The clash began with tear gas and then by bullets. Every year on this day, also known as Pupil Day, Iranians remember the massacre of a number of Tehran's students by the army of the Shah, including students as young as 13. That event made it clear that the confrontation between the Pahlavi regime and the Iranian people had entered its final stage, and that it could end only if the king was removed from power.
There were important points in the relationship between America and Iran which caused a feeling of anger amongst the youth and especially the Muslim student followers of the Imam's line. The most important event before the formation of the Islamic Revolution was the coup that the Americans carried out against the national and legal government of Iran. It happened during the time of Dr. Mossadegh against Iran. The Americans tried to destroy his government, which had come to power with the support of the people, because it had somehow endangered their interests in Iran and they wanted to bring back the Shah.
A few months later, on the occasion of the anniversary of Imam Khomeini's exile and the massacre of students, once again Iranian youth entered the arena and astonished the world. November 4th marks the day, 43 years ago, when Islamic students stormed the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and took 69 people. 17 of them were released at various times, but the remaining 52 remained captive for 444 days. It's worth mentioning that the day the U.S. Embassy was captured, the American administration was several times more formidable and prestigious than today. The United States has lost a great deal of its prestige in recent years.
When we look at the historical aspect, we see a background in which America played a role in the history of Iran. Well, the years after the Safavid period, when European countries seriously entered their relations with Iran, practically from the period of Reza Shah onwards, we see the Americans. And before this, most of the European countries, especially England, played a role. We can see the climax of this story from the coup that happened and the fall of Mossadegh's government. There's a famous saying that the only country in which a coup did not happen is the United States, because it does not have an embassy there.
The event was a watershed in Iran-U.S. relations, with its impact still felt today. The main consequence of that event has been that the Islamic Republic, the most important country in West Asia, and the United States, the global superpower, have not had diplomatic relations since the administration of Jimmy Carter. Moreover, over four decades of crises and scandals have marked Iran out as a graveyard for U.S. presidential ambition. This enmity has been further amplified by interest groups seeking to leverage U.S. policy for their own ends. While the Pahlavi lobby has faded away, organizations like the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee have since sought to refract U.S. policy towards Iran through the lens of Israel's regional security concerns. Israeli objectives in the Persian Gulf have evolved over time, often in ways which have not aligned with those of the U.S. governments. As the Biden administration soon discovered, the cumulative effects of a predecessor's actions can spill over and make it difficult to embark on a new course.
We have an interpretation in our hadith which means that you should be wary of cleverness of the believer, because he looks with the light of God and in that light examines the phenomena. Certainly, one of the most faithful personalities of our time was Imam Khomeini, and he truly studied the world and phenomena with God's light and finally saw clarity. The students who made this great embassy event said in their memoirs that they had not realized the greatness of it at the time.
The mentioned enmity between Washington and Tehran took a strange course, as the 1979 U.S. Embassy takeover got so bad for President Carter that he succumbed to the pressure by his advisors and resorted to a covert military attack to rescue the hostages. They deployed their spies inside the country. They prepared the ground. They spoke to different mercenaries. They considered different places for their operation. They attacked the country with their helicopters and airplanes. The plan was to regroup in Tabaz, northeast of Tehran, rescue the hostages, and take them to the U.S. But the unforeseen event happened in Tabaz, and Allah the Exalted destroyed their prestige, according to Ayatollah Khomeini. Their airplanes and helicopters caught fire, and they were forced to return to America from Tabaz. These are the events that the 13th of Aban represents.
We can address the question of what and why the capture of the spy den, or as the Americans interpreted, the embassy, in two parts. The first part has to do with the American performance from 1941 to 1979. We can go back to the period of Muhammad Shah, when they brought missionaries and laid the groundwork. Building schools, building churches, for example, the Anjani Church in Tehran was the center of Freemasonry. After that, they entered the field of power and government by sending military advisors to the army as a program called Truman's Four Principles. In fact, they looked at all the villages and the situation of the country to make a plan to destroy the production of the society and turn the country into a consumer society.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Here are some examples of the U.S. schemes against Iran extracted from the shredded documents found in the embassy. 1. U.S. attempts between 1943 to 1947 to maintain the Pahlavi regime by reining in the opposition forces as a means to strengthen the U.S. footing in Iran and prevent the USSR adventures into the country. 2. The U.S. and access to Iran's oil reserves meant that the U.S. relied on increasing political favor in Iran to become U.K.'s partner in Iranian oil. 3. On the occasion of the 1953 coup in Iran, the U.S. kicked out the nationalist administration of Mossadegh in favor of the U.S. servant Mohammad Reza Pahlavi and his regime so that its interests in Iran would be met. 4. The U.S. attempt to change economic structure and development of Iran led to the Shah's land reform policy, which is one of the changes that, according to Imam Khomeini, damaged domestic product and hindered the path of Iran's independence. 5. The advancement of economic-military relations between Iran and the U.S. to secure the Pahlavi regime can be seen in the multi-million dollar arms deal signed between Iran and the U.S. on June 21, 1947. There is plenty more right after a quick diversion into world media. Here is how it looks on the papers. CNN says Iran says it will sue U.S. alleging direct involvement in protests. Iran said Saturday it would take legal action against the United States and accusing it of direct involvement in the protests sweeping the country. Tehran also warned the United Kingdom and Saudi Arabia would not be ignored by the Islamic Republic's judiciary system for their role in hosting and supporting TV networks such as BBC Persian and Iran International, which it claimed had urged protesters to destroy public and private properties. Anti-government protests have gripped Iran since the September 16th death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini, who died after being pulled off the streets of Tehran by morality police and taken to a re-education center for lessons in modesty. The state news agency IRNA reported on Saturday that the Justice Department has been tasked to file a lawsuit in order to investigate the damages and meddling inflicted by the U.S. direct involvement in the unrest. It also reported the claims against the BBC and Iran International made by the deputy head of the Iranian judiciary and secretary of the country's High Council for Human Rights, Qasem Gharibabadi. Al Jazeera says Iran and U.S. set for UN confrontation over Mahsa Amini protests. A rare Iranian joint intelligence report claims arrested journalists who reported on Mahsa Amini's death were trained by the U.S. abroad. The Iranian intelligence community claimed the U.S. has spent billions of dollars over the years to create a network of sympathetic organizations and individuals, holding many gatherings and courses to teach hybrid wars and soft overthrow of the Iranian establishment. These all-paid courses, it said, have been held in Italy, South Africa, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates, among others, with or without the knowledge of those countries' governments. The report uses the initials of two female Iranian journalists, whom it says were trained by the courses of the U.S. mafia regime in foreign countries and played the role of being the first sources to manufacture news for foreign media on developments concerning Amini that led to the protest. The reporters accused by Iranian intelligence are Niloufar Hamadi and Elahi Mohammadi, who were arrested shortly after protests broke out last month and remain imprisoned in Evin prison in Tehran. Hamadi was among the first to report on Amini's death at the hospital, while Mohammadi traveled to Amini's hometown of Saqqez to report on her funeral. The intelligence report also alleges that CIA officials met with Kurdish separatist groups in neighboring Iraq's northern Erbil region in late September to ask them to amplify their role in Iran's unrest. The father of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, hailed the heroic takeover of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran in 1979 by Muslim students as the Second Revolution. The U.S. Embassy in Tehran, long detested by Iranians for its highly suspicious and undiplomatic activities, turned out to be an espionage den. The seized gadgets and documents revealed startling facts. The Americans, in